If you guys haven't noticed the buzz in the room for Emily being here, it is my great pleasure to introduce Emily Cates. She is one of my friends and has played such an important role in my walk with Christ. So I thank her, and I'm so happy that she's here. Emily is a Chicago native who has lived and learned in Santa Barbara, Kenya, and in Denver. She's a happy resident of Encinitas. She's a stay-at-home mom to three children. And tries to keep her master's in communication alive through writing projects and leadership roles here at Solana Beach Presbyterian Church and at MOPS. She's really excited about a new volunteering position at the Pregnancy Resource Center in Vista. And her favorite quote and daily goal is, "Wherever you are, be all there. Live to the hilt every situation you believe to be the will of God." And here's Emily.
Thanks.
You want?
I think. Hi, thank you so much for having me. I don't do this speak, so just bear with me if I have some technical things. Oh, look at that. So good morning. Thanks, Lauren, for that introduction. Okay, you guys, MOPS is the best. Isn't MOPS the best? Just think about what you're doing right now. You are sitting like your mom, and you're sitting for a prolonged period of time. Your children are not here. There are some babies here, but those are the easy ones. The hard kids are not here. They're being taken care of by loving, wonderful individuals. You are surrounded by people who are walking in this wonderful and crazy stage of life with you. You can hear me all right, right? Okay. And when I think of MOPS, I think of it like one big deep breath. So I hope today can just be like a deep breath for you. Even my little three-year-old is in childcare, so even though I'm speaking, it's actually still like a deep breath for me. So I have been given the great honor to talk to you today, and I'm going to share with you a little bit of my story, and I'm going to talk to you about vulnerability. And lo and behold, I am already feeling quite vulnerable. And I'm feeling vulnerable because why am I qualified to talk to you today? I have written no books. I am not a professional speaker. I have a very, very dusty master's degree in communication, and I am just a stay-at-home mom. But what qualifies me to talk to you today is that I'm one of you. I'm just a MOPS mom. I retired a little early last year from MOPS after 8 years, and MOPS has been an incredible gift in my life, so I'm thrilled to be able to give back by sharing some of my story. So, MOPS. I am one of you, and I think over the 8 years that I've been in MOPS, I've walked into this room as many different versions of my mommy self. I, in my first group in Colorado, was a brand new mom who had a three-month-old and was feeling pretty insecure about being around all the veteran mommies, and I was just trying to fake it till I made it. I then, 2 years later, was again the brand new mom in this room, this time just having moved to California and not knowing a single soul in San Diego County. That felt vulnerable. I've been the joyful and content mom, feeling totally plugged in and at home in this group, and more times than I can even count, I've been the utterly, utterly depleted mom sitting at this table, just taking that deep breath that I hope you are today. One time, I was the absolutely mortified mommy when my newborn had a bright yellow, huge blowout all over my new MOPS friend's brand new white shirt. That was an awesome moment that I'll never forget. And then I didn't have a change of clothes, so I scattered to the bathroom and spent the rest of the meeting holding a baby in a diaper and a blanket, because I sure as heck was not going to leave the meeting early. Like many of you, I have come into this room feeling thankful and fearful, joyful and lonely, overwhelmed and content, frustrated and satisfied. And truly, that's what qualifies me to talk to you today, is I'm just one of you. And the reality is, any of you could come up here and talk also, because we all have a story to share and we all have so much to teach each other. In the past 2 years, in October, we've typically had a panel. And on that panel, we've had the chance to listen to a little bit of four or five women's stories. And I know for those of you who've experienced the panel, we will not soon forget the courage and bravery and wisdom that was shared by those women. Now, the panel was the idea for that, and the idea for just hearing from women in the room was inspired by the MOPS yearly themes. And I think in the last 3 years, MOPS has knocked the themes out of the ballpark. This year, a fierce flourishing, love that, so strong. Last year, be you bravely. And the year before that, which was my personal favorite, a beautiful mess, embrace your story. And that year, they gave some of the leadership a necklace that said a beautiful mess, and I wear it all the time because I think that is just an excellent life motto for this phase of life. And when I look at those themes, I feel like I hear or I see some threads running through them. Be you, share you, embrace who you are, have courage, be vulnerable. I feel like it's kind of a build-up, those themes, like the beautiful mess, acknowledge that you and your life are a beautiful mess, embrace that story that's all yours, and then be brave and put that story out there. And in doing that, you will flourish fiercely. These people really think through their themes, and it's clear what they want for you to be your MOPS experience. So basically, that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to share a bit of my story, and my story is not particularly extraordinary, but it's all mine. And I share it with you today in hopes of encouraging you to embrace your story as a part of your fierce flourishing this year. So just because I'm a little nervous, I'm going to start in prayer for a minute. So just bow your heads with me. Lord God, I thank you for today. I thank you for MOPS and the deep breath that it is. I pray today that your spirit is here and that you help me be brave to have the words that I need to say, and that you help everyone sitting down to be brave to hear the words that you would have them hear. Help us today ultimately to just draw closer to each other and to you, and just give us peace. In your name, amen. So, my story. A little background. I'm going to move this because I feel like I'm going to knock into it. I'm from Chicago, as they said. And really, just please raise your hand if you're also from Chicago so I can know who my people are. Okay, there are a few. Awesome. And go Cubs, right? I mean, go Cubs. Okay, so I went to college in California. I started marriage and motherhood in Colorado, and we've lived in San Diego for the past 6 years. I'm certain that we will be here forever because my husband surfs, and now he has my children surfing. So this is going to be home forever, I'm sure. On Monday, Chris and I are going to be celebrating 13 years of marriage, and this picture was taken right before a nighttime zip lining date that we had this summer at Forest Home Family Camp. This is also a shameless plug for Forest Home Family Camp. Talk to Heather Michael. Yes, if you're interested, it's totally, totally amazing. It was our first year going this year. Let's see, growing up, I always had a very strong feeling that I was going to have all boys, and I just knew that I was going to be a really, really good boy mom. So I want to introduce you to my kids. Samantha, age 8, Abby, age 5, and Hannah, age 3. That picture is darling, but not entirely accurate. This one is a little bit more like real life. I am for sure 3 for 3 in having strong, spunky, spirited, sassy, stubborn, what other good S words are there? Sweet little girls. And I just want to say this, just this. They are obviously the loves of my life, the best thing that has ever happened to me. And they just make me so tired. And I tell them that. Is that bad that I tell them that? So a little more background that's important to my story. I am the oldest of 3 girls, and I'm a very typical firstborn child. I'm actually the firstborn child of 2 firstborn children, which for sure makes me like extra firstborn. And what I mean by that is my natural bent is type A, organized, structured, tidy, neat. I like control. I like predictability. I battle perfectionism. I like productivity. And did I mention I love control? Of course, 3 kids has turned my life into total chaos, and I've had to give pretty much all of that up, which has made motherhood super duper easy for me. Nope. And of course, as is often the case, I married my complete opposite, a laid-back, type B surfing last-born child, which has made marriage super duper easy also. One thing I was not historically very good at was vulnerability, mostly because vulnerability in my mind was the opposite of control. I approached life and friendship pretty much in the same way, trying to convince myself and others that I had it all together and that I knew what I was doing. I was private, I was in control, I was strong, I was independent, and as a result, I was probably a bit distant. A really honest friend once told me that I was a really hard nut to crack. And you gotta love honest friends, right? So let me pick up our story 4 years into marriage. Life was ticking along beautifully and going pretty much how I wanted it to. We were enjoying fun, kid-free years of marriage. We were getting degrees, getting our first jobs. We were married really young, so we were just figuring out how to be adults together, really. We were making friends. Oh, sorry, I have a hair in my mouth. And we were just, in general, building our life. I knew that real life was full of curveballs, but so far I had been doing a pretty good job planning hard enough, praying hard enough, working hard enough, and being determined enough for life to go how I wanted it to go. And can you sense where my story is going? So after successfully keeping a plant, a fish, and a puppy alive, we decided that we were ready for children. And I'm really not kidding you, that was kind of our criteria. But in full disclosure, we killed a few fish. So I don't know, we should have waited a little longer. So we got pregnant right away, which was such a blessing, and went out and took a picture of, well, didn't go out, I don't think we were developing film at that time, took a picture of the pregnancy test. I literally ran out, I think, the next day about what to expect when you're expecting. And just celebrated, and I was excited. I convinced myself I was feeling sick and tired, and I was ready to be pregnant. And then, 6 weeks into the pregnancy, I had a miscarriage. I was young, and I didn't know many people. I didn't have this mommy community yet, so I didn't know many people who'd been through that. And I was devastated. To make matters worse, I felt like I wasn't allowed to be devastated, because I was only 6 weeks along, and it was such a common experience. But as those of you who've been through that know, pregnant is pregnant, and you embrace that baby at 4 weeks the same way you do at 40 weeks. Then I also had this weird feeling, which was of shame. I felt ashamed that I had had a miscarriage, and I felt like I was letting a lot of people down, and like I had done something wrong. I was very quiet about the miscarriage and really only told a very limited number of friends and family and just kept it to myself. So we followed the doctor's instructions. We waited the recommended time and then we tried again and got pregnant again right away. So that felt good, back on track. And then again, this time at 7 weeks, this time at work, I had another miscarriage. So this time there were a lot of questions swirling through my mind. Why? Why me? What did I do wrong? What's wrong with me? What if I can never have kids? Which was a question I had never pondered before and was utterly terrifying. And I was sad and terrified and, again, kept pretty quiet about it. We were kind of forced to tell a group of friends because we had to cancel a social event and we told them the reason we couldn't make it. They wanted us to come anyway, but I could not do it because, again, I felt shame, which I knew that I shouldn't, but I did. And I just felt that letting my friends see me sad and broken was the epitome of losing control. So again, stayed very much to ourselves, and it was extremely lonely, extremely lonely. So again, we tried, got pregnant, and this time, of course, I was downright terrified. But this time, we made it to that first doctor's appointment, saw that little flutter on the screen, saw that little jumping bean moving around, let my guard down, and just settled in, and settled into a very long, lovely 41 weeks of pregnancy, and had a great delivery, and we had our baby girl, Samantha. So when Samantha came along, I quit my job and decided that motherhood and a master's degree would be a fun combination. And it actually was, for the most part. I loved being a mommy. I was one of those, like, over the top. And you can imagine, having gone through the miscarriages, I was, oh my word, over the top mommy. I felt like I was pretty good at it. Samantha was a great baby, and we decided that we should add one more. So I timed the pregnancy perfectly, so I'd be due 2 weeks after my graduation, and they would be 2 weeks apart, back to the control issues. It's amazing. It doesn't take long to kind of get back into that habit. And then again, I had another uneventful pregnancy. I loved watching my belly grow, and I loved feeling the baby move inside me from a really early point in pregnancy, and was just excited to have to add to our family. Then at 18 weeks, I had some unusual symptoms, and because I was a bit paranoid from the early miscarriages, we went to the ER one Sunday morning, and we were there for a long time. We got checked out, had many blood tests, a thorough ultrasound where they managed to keep the gender of the baby a secret, which was what we wanted. And they checked me out and said they didn't know. I looked fine. Baby looked fine. It was just one of those things. So they sent me home, and I was obviously very relieved. So later that Sunday night, we said goodbye to some friends who had come over for dinner, and I got some pretty bad cramping. And I figured it was something that I ate. I did call the on-call doctor, and because again, I was nervous, and they just predicted that it was probably gas pains because I had been to the ER that whole day, so everything was fine. So the cramps continued, and I endured, and they'd come and they'd go, and then all of a sudden, my water broke. And I knew, it was one of those moments where the world goes from black and white to color, and I suddenly realized what was going on, and I realized it wasn't gas pains, it wasn't something I ate. It was labor. I had been in labor, and my water just broke. So I knew that at 18 weeks, this was very, very, very bad. So we scrambled, and we got someone to come to our house to be with Samantha, who was sleeping. And we rushed to the ER, and I was laying down in the back seat because I couldn't even sit up. They rushed me into an ER triage room, and after a rapid and terrible sequence of events that will always be both a blur and crystal clear in my mind, they handed me the tiny, perfect, still baby boy that I had just delivered. They wrapped him tenderly in a blanket, and they put him in my arms. I remember really clearly the nurse saying, "It's a boy," and I remember Chris and I looking at each other with like excited and surprised eyes, and then of course with deep, deep sadness. I remember just saying over and over again, "I don't understand, I don't understand." That was all I could say. I remember that he was tiny, but that it actually took two hands to hold him. And I remember just being in shock. They brought us to the recovery room and gave us time. We made terribly, terribly hard phone calls in the middle of the night. We wept. We prayed. We named him Benjamin. We just took time looking at his perfect little body and counting fingers and toes, just what you would do with your baby. And then after a few hours, we said goodbye. And nothing can describe that feeling of handing over your baby. The next morning, this was all in the middle of the night, so when the sun came up, they let us go home quickly, which was great. But we went home, obviously, empty-handed and totally brokenhearted. And it had all just happened so incredibly fast. I distinctly remember getting home from the hospital and realizing that we had a choice to make. Let people in or don't, be vulnerable or not. It was not our nature or our practice as a couple to be vulnerable. We just were independent and strong and stayed to ourselves. But we knew that this time needed to be different. I wrote an email to friends and family telling them what had happened and just essentially put our pain out there. Within a few hours, my dad and sister had booked tickets from Chicago to come be with us. And then a dear friend of Chris's asked if he could come be with us. And amazingly, I said yes. I even asked for prayer on Facebook, actually, which was not like me, but I just felt like I needed all the prayer that I could get. So shortly after returning home from the hospital, the doorbell rang. A dear friend named Emily actually walked in the door with a gallon of milk and groceries and tears. She didn't call ahead, she just showed up. She was very vulnerable. I remember Chris telling me that she was there, and I remember desperately just wanting to pull the covers over my head and not see anybody. But I chose to come down the stairs. And I feel like, honestly, in my story, walking down those stairs was the symbolic moment for me where I chose to give vulnerability a shot. I chose to let my dear friend Emily see me totally broken. And it was scary, but it felt so good after I did it. So good. In the weeks that followed our loss, I chose to be vulnerable over and over again. I had had such a positive experience with all of our early visitors and the early support that we received that I realized there was something to this vulnerability thing. I was honest with my husband, my family, my friends, and with God. There's no more hiding or being strong, no faking that everything was okay, no handling things on my own. I was a mess, and I was out there for the world to see. I was most definitely not in control. If someone asked me how I was doing, I told them. I said yes to support, which even that was unlike me because I didn't need help. But I said yes to the support. I let my MOPS table bring me food, which was the first time I'd ever experienced that, because when I had my first baby, it wasn't in MOPS. So even that was extremely vulnerable, to let people come over and bring us food. I grieved hard. I mourned for our baby as if he had been a full-term baby or an infant that I had been able to know and love, because to me, truly, he was no different. We chose to be vulnerable even in our mourning, and we decided to honor our little Benjamin that we were going to have a memorial service, and we invited our close friends to come be a part of that service with us. Privacy would have been fine and totally understandable, but honestly, openness just felt so much better. And the vulnerability in those days, the giving of it, the receiving of it, was literally life-giving to me. The result of that vulnerability is that relationships just went to a whole another level. And the vulnerability led to the gift of intimacy. Honestly, if there's one thing that you take away from today, it's that. Just remember that vulnerability leads to intimacy. And it did in our friendships. Our friendships went to a different place. They felt different. They felt right. It felt like how friendship should feel. It was refreshing to just live out in the open, to be open and honest, not to waste energy trying to be strong and be in control, because truly that does take a lot of energy. My heart started to heal, and I just kept practicing vulnerability. And over the months that followed our loss, it became more comfortable and more natural for me. So a mere 5 months after our loss, we decided we hadn't had enough, and we moved to California. Hadn't had enough going on. So actually, sorry, within 5 months of losing the baby, I graduated from grad school, and then a couple weeks after that, we moved to California. So as in, we left the life that we had built and every thing we knew and everyone we knew for those 7 years in Colorado, and basically started life over from scratch. That's a long story and a whole nother talk in terms of how that all happened. The move itself, honestly, felt like one big act of vulnerability, especially with God. I told God I trusted him to take care of us. I begged him to bring us community and a sense of home quickly. I offered him my brokenness and asked him to please use it for good someday in some way. Although we left everything we knew behind, what I brought with me from Colorado to California was my new vulnerable approach to life. The only place that I could think of in terms of building a life over from scratch, in terms of a place to start doing that, was MOPS, because I had been in MOPS for a couple years in Colorado. So about 9 months after losing the baby, and 3 months after moving to California, and one day after moving into our home in Encinitas, I walked through those doors. Oh yeah, choke up more at that part. And I walked into this MOPS group. I was newly pregnant again by that time, so I was terrified about that. I was lonely. I was more depressed than I had ever been in my life. And I was so broken and tired and lonely and scared that I figured I had nothing to lose. So I just was real at my table and just offered who I was to these women. And truly, God put me at exactly the right table that year. I quickly discovered that when you give someone the gift of your vulnerability, you invite them to give the gift of their vulnerability back to you. And friendships formed fast. I asked these new women at my table for prayer. Even that was not something that I had done before. I joined a women's small group at this church. We joined this church, which has also just been a life-changing experience, being part of this church community. I invited people over to my messy and chaotic house with my wild little two-year-old. I said yes to things that made me uncomfortable. I showed up to events that were outside of my comfort zone. And I took risks, basically. I feel like I took risks socially, emotionally, and relationally. And honestly, over and over again, I know I keep saying this, but it just felt good. It felt right. So I had my second daughter during that first year in MOPS, and because God has a sense of humor and likes to keep teaching me that I'm not in control, daughter number three came along about a year sooner than we had planned, and so I've been basically overwhelmed with my little three blessings ever since. In case you're keeping track, which you might be, none of my children came when I planned or expected them to come. And all of my children came as a result of the babies that I lost, which is something that I think about, honestly, when I enjoy my life with my three girls. There is a verse in the Bible that I want to share, Ephesians 3:20-21, that says, "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his work, his power that is at work within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen." I feel like God has truly done immeasurably more than I could ask or imagine with me and for me and in me. He took my hurt and my pain and my courage to be vulnerable and honestly transformed me into a new person, someone who's more healed, more whole, more honest, more empathetic, and more compassionate than I was before. There's also a beautiful verse in Isaiah that has kind of become a life verse for me. It talks about how God makes beauty from ashes. I have seen this countless times in my life, but never more than in my story of Benjamin. When I think of Benjamin now, 7 years later, he is like an angel to me. And he'll always be part of our life and part of our family, not because of his presence or his person, but because of the space that he created, space that was once very empty, very dark, but has filled in with so much beauty. I think sometimes we need those empty spaces for beauty to fill in. I think sometimes we need the ashes so God can make beauty from them. I think sometimes we need loss to experience new joys. The theme of my story is vulnerability, obviously. The deeper story, though, is how God changed me. And you can ask my husband, he really, really did change me. Through my pain and my loss and my choice to be vulnerable, he drew me into deeper connections with others and ultimately deeper connection and deeper relationship with him. So vulnerability has now become one of my favorite topics. Obviously, I'm here talking to you today about it. And I want to just say a few things about vulnerability. But I brought an extra resource with me to talk about vulnerability. I just read this book. Actually, when Lauren asked me if I'd do this, I was just finishing up reading this book, which felt like confirmation that I should do this. It's called Daring Greatly by Brené Brown, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. Brené Brown is obviously an author. She's a very smart woman, a social worker, a PhD, MSW, researcher, educator, smart lady. Oprah really likes her, if that lends any credibility. She really does. Endearing Greatly, Brené Brown focuses on her decade of research on vulnerability. So, imagine this is what researchers do. They research something like vulnerability for a decade. So in her book, I just want to roll through some of her conclusions. She concludes that connection is why we are here. We're made for connection. It's what gives our lives meaning, and without it, there is suffering. She talks about connection. She defines connection as love and belonging, and identifies that love and belonging are impossible to experience without vulnerability. Vulnerability she defines as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. And vulnerability she identifies as the core, the heart, the center of meaningful human experiences. She found that the thing that unravels vulnerability or connection is shame. And she defines shame simply as the feeling that we're not enough. So I'm not blank enough. You could fill in the blank with a million things. I'm not blank enough to show you the real me. Or I have experienced something, and because of that experience in my past, I can't show you the real me. She calls that shame. At one point in her research, she finds that she thinks there are just two kinds of people in the world. Those with a strong sense of worthiness or love and belonging, and those people she calls the wholehearted. Then the other group are the group that do not experience strong feelings of worthiness or love and belonging. So what I want to do real quick with you is show you a clip from her TED Talk. If you haven't heard of TED Talks, look it up when you get home, TED.com. It's just a forum for sharing lots of great ideas and usually short talks. I'm going to show you a 10-minute clip, which will be worth the 10 minutes, I promise. And where she's going to pick up in this clip is halfway through her talk. So you might feel like you're catching up a little bit, but you'll catch up. And what she's about to talk about is what she found the wholehearted have in common. What are the common characteristics of that group, the wholehearted? Obviously, being a wholehearted person is something that we would all like to be, and we would like our children to be. I'd encourage you to just try to grab on to just even one little thing that she shares here. And after this clip, I'm going to just briefly go through five areas where I think we can practice vulnerability just in our real lives. I should, one second, warn you. I actually didn't Oh, good. I didn't tell the coordinators this. But there is an expletive in this video. I'm sorry. She uses God's name in a questionable way a couple times. I go to church in this room, but I feel like it's still okay to show you this. And her expletive is actually very well used. But I'm sorry that I did, that's, you know, happening here.
And I started looking at the data. In fact, I did it first in this very four-day, very intensive data analysis where I went back, pulled these interviews, pulled the stories, pulled the incidents. What's the theme? What's the pattern? My husband left town with the kids. Because I always go into this kind of Jackson Pollock crazy thing where I'm just like writing and going and kind of just in my researcher mode. And so here's what I found. What they had in common was a sense of courage. And I want to separate courage and bravery for you for a minute. Courage, the original definition of courage, when it first came into the English language, it's from the Latin word cur, meaning heart. And the original definition was to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And so these folks had, very simply, the courage to be imperfect. They had the compassion to be kind to themselves first and then to others, because as it turns out, we can't practice compassion with other people if we can't treat ourselves kindly. And the last was they had connection, and this was the hard part, as a result of authenticity. They were willing to let go of who they thought they should be in order to be who they were, which is, you have to absolutely do that for connection. The other thing that they had in common was this. They fully embraced vulnerability. They believed that what made them vulnerable made them beautiful. They didn't talk about vulnerability being comfortable, nor did they really talk about it being excruciating, as I had heard earlier in the shame interviewing. They just talked about it being necessary. They talked about the willingness to say, I love you first. The willingness to do something where there are no guarantees. The willingness to breathe through waiting for the doctor to call after your mammogram. The willing to invest in a relationship that may or may not work out. They thought this was fundamental. I personally thought it was betrayal. I could not believe I had pledged allegiance to research, where our job, you know, the definition of research is to control and predict, to study phenomenon for the reason, for the explicit reason to control and predict. And now my very, you know, my mission to control and predict had turned up the answer that the way to live is with vulnerability and to stop controlling and predicting. This led to a little breakdown, which actually looked more like this. And it did. It led to I call it a breakdown. My therapist calls it a spiritual awakening. Spiritual awakening sounds better than breakdown, but I assure you it was a breakdown. And I had to put my data away and go find a therapist. Let me tell you something. You know who you are when you call your friends and say, I think I need to see somebody. Who, do you have any recommendations? Because about five of my friends are like, woo, I wouldn't want to be your therapist. And I was like, what does that mean? And they're like, I'm just saying, you know, like, don't bring your measuring stick. Like, okay. So I found a therapist. My first meeting with her, Diana, I brought in my list of the way the wholehearted live. And I sat down, and she said, you know, how are you? And I said, I'm great, you know, I'm okay. And she said, what's going on? And I said, and this is a therapist who sees therapists, because we have to go to those, because their BS meters are good. And so I said, here's the thing, I'm struggling. And she said, what's the struggle? And I said, well, I have a vulnerability issue. And, you know, and I know that vulnerability is kind of the core, of shame and fear and our struggle for worthiness, but it appears that it's also the birthplace of joy, of creativity, of belonging, of love. And I think I have a problem. And I need some help. And I said, but here's the thing. No family stuff, no childhood shit. I just need some strategies. Thank you. So she goes like this. And then I said, it's bad, right? And she said, it's neither good nor bad. It just is what it is. And I said, oh my God, this is going to suck. And it did, and it didn't. And it took about a year. And you know how there are people that, like, when they realize that vulnerability and tenderness are important, that they kind of surrender and walk into it? A, that's not me. And B, I don't even hang out with people like that. For me, it was a year-long street fight. It was a slugfest. Vulnerability pushed, I pushed back. I lost the fight, but probably won my life back. And so then I went back into the research and spent the next couple of years really trying to understand what they, the wholehearted, what the choices they were making, and what are we doing with vulnerability? Why do we struggle with it so much? Am I alone in struggling with vulnerability? No. So this is what I learned. We numb vulnerability. When we're waiting for the call, it was funny. I sent something out on Twitter and on Facebook that says, how would you define vulnerability? What makes you feel vulnerable? And within an hour and a half, I had 150 responses. Because I wanted to know, you know, what's out there? Having to ask my husband for help because I'm sick and we're newly married. Initiating sex with my husband. Initiating sex with my wife. Being turned down. Asking someone out. Waiting for the doctor to call back, getting laid off, laying off people. This is the world we live in. We live in a vulnerable world. And one of the ways we deal with it is we numb vulnerability. And I think there's evidence, and it's not the only reason this evidence exists, but I think that it's a huge cause. We are the most in debt, obese, addicted, and medicated adult cohort in U.S. history. The problem is, and I learned this from the research, that you cannot selectively numb emotion. You can't say, here's the bad stuff. Here's vulnerability. Here's grief. Here's shame. Here's fear. Here's disappointment. I don't want to feel these. I'm going to have a couple of beers and a banana nut muffin. I don't want to feel these. And I know that's knowing laughter. I hack into your lives for a living. I know that's God. You can't numb those hard feelings without numbing the other affects or emotions. You cannot selectively numb. So when we numb those, we numb joy. We numb gratitude. We numb happiness. And then we are miserable, and we are looking for purpose and meaning, and then we feel vulnerable, so then we have a couple of beers and a banana nut muffin. And it becomes this dangerous cycle. One of the things that I think that we need to think about is why and how we numb. And it doesn't just have to be addiction. The other thing we do is we make everything that's uncertain, certain. Religion has gone from a belief in faith and mystery to certainty. I'm right, you're wrong, shut up. That's it. Just certain. The more afraid we are, the more vulnerable we are, the more afraid we are. This is what politics looks like today. There's no discourse anymore. There's no conversation. There's just blame. You know what blame? You know how blame is described in the research? A way to discharge pain and discomfort. We perfect. If there's anyone who wants their life to look like this, it would be me. But it doesn't work. Because what we do is we take fat from our butts and put it in our cheeks. Which just, I hope in 100 years people will look back and go, wow. You know. And we perfect, most dangerously, our children. Let me tell you what we think about children. They're hardwired for struggle when they get here. When you hold those perfect little babies in your hand, our job is not to say, look at her, she's perfect. My job is just to keep her perfect, make sure she makes the tennis team by fifth grade and Yale by seventh grade. That's not our job. Our job is to look and say, you know what? You're imperfect and you're wired for struggle, but you are worthy of love and belonging. That's our job. Show me a generation of kids raised like that and we'll end the problems I think that we see today. We pretend that what we do doesn't have an effect on people. We do that in our personal lives. We do that corporate, whether it's a bailout, an oil spill, a recall. We pretend like what we're doing doesn't have a huge impact on other people. I would say to companies, this is not our first rodeo, people. We just need you to be authentic and real and say, we're sorry, we'll fix it. But there's another way, and I'll leave you with this. This is what I have found. To let ourselves be seen. Deeply seen. Vulnerably seen. To love with our whole hearts, even though there's no guarantee. And that's really hard. And I can tell you as a parent, that's excruciatingly difficult. To practice gratitude and joy in those moments of kind of terror when we're wondering, can I love you this much? Can I believe in this passionately? Can I be this fierce about this? Just to be able to stop and instead of catastrophizing what might happen, to say, I'm just so grateful. Because to feel this vulnerable means I'm alive. And the last, which I think is probably the most important, is to believe that we're enough. Because when we work from a place, I believe, that says, I'm enough, then we stop screaming and start listening. We're kinder and gentler to the people around us, and we're kinder and gentler to ourselves. That's all I have. Thank
you. That was Brené Brown, recorded at TEDx Houston in Houston, Texas, June 2010. For more information on TED, visit TED.com.
So I recently learned that her breakdown / spiritual awakening was actually the catalyst to her returning to her faith, to God, to the church, after a long hiatus. And that makes sense to me, actually, because when you look at her research and the topics she's talking about, connection, relationship, overcoming shame, worthiness, love and belonging, letting ourselves be seen, loving with our whole hearts, practicing gratitude and joy, believing that we are enough. To me, all of that sounds like the life that God wants for us. It sounds to me like the path we take when we walk in relationship with our loving, forgiving, saving, merciful, gracious Savior. And ultimately, that's where her research brought her. I'm sure she didn't expect it to bring her there, but it brought her back to God, which I think is kind of a neat part of her story. So I hope that what she said sticks with you. I would encourage you to watch that whole 20-minute talk at some point and to pick up a copy of her book. It's awesome, and she has some other books, a new one that's out too, I think. I want to end by quickly, I'm sorry, I'm going to go over a little bit, touching on five areas where we can practice vulnerability in our real lives. Now, this is not Brené, this is just Emily, so it's not going to sound as intelligent and it's not as well researched. So the five areas are self, others, spouse, children, and God. So first is self. So that might sound funny, practicing vulnerability with yourself, but what I mean is this. I think that often the courage to be vulnerable comes out of a sense of knowing who we are and being secure with ourselves. I don't know about you, but motherhood and marriage are really great mirrors I feel like I have learned more about myself watching myself mother than I actually really ever cared to know. And I think we can do ourselves a service by paying attention to ourselves and asking ourselves questions. What are we good at? What are we bad at? Where are we strong? Where are we weak? Where do we need help? Where do we have a lot left over to give? An example of this is from my life is that I recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, realized that I'm an introvert. I love people. I clearly talk a lot. but I refuel alone. And I can't tell you what an amazing discovery this has been for me, because it's helped me see that my often desperate need to escape my children and my husband are not because I'm a bad mom, but it's because I'm an introvert. And this has helped the whole family dynamic, just for mommy to realize that about herself. So I think in general, when we have a better understanding of how we work, we're going to work better in different areas of our life. So what this could look like is picking up a book about personality or temperament, taking a personality test, going to therapy. Later in the spring, you're going to have a speaker, I think, that's going to talk about the SHAPE assessment. Is that right? And that's an awesome tool that this church offers that you could do this afternoon if you want. It's online, where you learn. It's an assessment that you take, and you learn how your gifts, your heart, your ability, your personality, and your experience works together to make you you, and to allow you to give gifts to everybody around you. So there are a lot of different ways you can be vulnerable and learn about yourself. The next area is vulnerability with others. Others such as friends, family, coworkers, neighbors, and MOPS is a great place to be vulnerable and practice being vulnerable with others. I do want to say one thing. I don't want you to hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that vulnerability is just being completely honest with everyone all the time. I'm not saying it's spilling your guts everywhere, blasting your problems on social media. That can actually sometimes be the opposite of vulnerability. True vulnerability is a shared experience. It happens within a relationship where there's trust and there's reciprocal sharing. I also want to say, oops, I lost my water. I also want to say that I know some of you are sitting here today probably thinking that you've tried vulnerability and it didn't work out that well, that you maybe it left you feeling rejected or more lonely, or it wasn't reciprocated. And I want to say, yes, I've been there. We've all been there. That's why vulnerability is a risk and takes courage. And I just want to encourage you, if you've tried vulnerability and it has not worked out, bless you, sweet baby, don't close off. Try again. I keep using the word practice vulnerability because I think truly it's something we just need to practice over and over to get better at it and more comfortable with it. So baby steps in the practice of vulnerability could be, in this room, going a little bit deeper in your joys and challenges. Sharing something that takes a tiny bit more emotional exposure on your part. It could be answering the question, how are you, in a really real and authentic way. One of my favorite things to do is when people ask me, how are you, instead of just, the return, fine, how are you? I will actually take a minute and take a deep breath and think about the answer and then give them a little something. And 9 times out of 10, it leads to a way more interesting and connecting conversation than if I had just said, fine. Of course, there is 1 time out of 10 where it's totally awkward and it flops. But, that's just part of the risk, and that's all right. Another approach to vulnerability with others, beyond sharing, verbally, is just doing things. Showing up for friends is a great way, like my friend Emily did after our loss. Do you have a friend that's in pain? Be vulnerable and show up at their door. Call them, even though you have no idea what to say. Offer to pray for them, and not just pray for them, but in the moment, pray for them. Offer yourselves to them. Sometimes you need to force yourselves upon them. I have friendships that are deep, that are the direct result of people stepping into my pain or me taking the risk to step into their pain. A great quote from one of my favorite authors, and those of my friends in the room are thinking, wow, it took Emily this long to mention Jen Hatmaker? So here she is. When you tell me the truth about yourself, I no longer hide from you. You become safe for me. So guess what? Now you are the recipient of my truth too. Your vulnerability makes a path for my own. So a third area is spouse. This one might seem obvious because we're married to them, so obviously we're vulnerable with them. But you probably know that that can be hard sometimes. We had a rough period in our marriage that was the direct result of me not being vulnerable, not sharing truly what I was feeling about something, what I was feeling about him, what I was feeling about a situation. And it led to the building and bubbling of resentment. And resentment, obviously, is not good for marriage. It wasn't until I started being honest with him, and this was actually on the topic of moving to California, it wasn't until I started really sharing with him how I was feeling that we were able to work ourselves back to each other emotionally. Maybe for you, vulnerability with your spouse looks like really sharing something that's going on in your heart, or admitting that you're struggling, maybe asking for help. Maybe it's simply asking your husband to go to church with you. Maybe it's working on that family mission statement that you guys talked about last meeting. Maybe it's going to therapy to strengthen your marriage. The fourth area is children. There's a great chapter in Daring Greatly where she talks about a whole chapter on vulnerability and parenting. She talks about how essential it is for us to let our children truly see us, to truly see us and truly know us, our strengths and our weaknesses. Her main conclusion in that chapter was this: who we are and how we engage with the world are much stronger predictors of how our children will do than what we know about parenting. So this is both comforting and terrifying because it's all about modeling, right? They're watching us all the time. So we need to be the people that we want them to become someday. And finally, there is God. God and I have always been pretty close, but with like with any relationship, a relationship is truly tested in trial and in crisis. So my faith was really tested in my pain and loss of losing the baby and then in our transition to California. As I've already said, God proved himself immensely loving and completely faithful, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't really hard along the way. When I was in crisis in those days after losing the baby, I wrestled with him and I cried out to him and I questioned him in ways that I never had before. Questions like, why? How could this happen? How could a stupid infection that no one knew I had take the life of a perfectly healthy baby? Why would you create a world and let such hardship happen in it? How could a good God let hard things happen to people that love him, to good people? How do you explain all this suffering? I told him how much it hurt. I asked him to help me. I asked him to redeem it. I just was honest with him. And truly, I have never felt so close to God as I did during those first few days and weeks after losing the baby. I want to encourage you to be honest with God, with your joys or with your trials. He can take it. That's what he wants from you. He wants your vulnerability. It's just a relationship. He wants you to be honest and not just bring him your shiny, happy parts, but bring him your brokenness and your broken hallelujahs as well. I am going to end for real this time. I skipped this. This is just a verse that kind of sums up what it was like those days after the loss, that I felt like when we, and it's a promise. It's a promise that is for all of us. When we draw near to God, he will draw near to us, which is one of my favorite simple promises that's in Scripture. If there are two things that you remember from this talk, let this be the second one, that when you draw near to him, he will draw near to you. So I really am going to end this time, and I'm going to end with twinkle lights. Are you ready for my visual aid? Ah! Brené Brown. I can't wait to tell my kids that I brought these to talk. They're going to think I'm so cool. Okay, so Brené Brown uses twinkle lights as a metaphor for shared vulnerability. So I'm going to read you a little bit from her, and I just want you to look at the twinkle lights while I read. When we reach out and share ourselves, our fears, hopes, struggles, joy, we create small sparks of connection. Our shared vulnerability creates light in normally dark places. The lights are small, and a single light is not very special, but an entire strand of sparkling lights is sheer beauty. It's the connectivity that makes them beautiful. When it comes to vulnerability, connectivity means sharing our stories with people who have earned the right to hear them, people with whom we've cultivated relationships that can bear the weight of our story. Is there trust? Is there mutual empathy? Is there reciprocal sharing? Can we ask for what we need? The most powerful moments of our lives happen when we string together the small flickers of light created by courage, compassion, and connection, and see them shine in the darkness of our struggles. And I want to bring it even a step further and just say also that I think when we shine by sharing vulnerability with others, we also shine our little twinkle lights for God. I believe that God made us to be vulnerable. I think that we thrive and we flourish when we're vulnerable, when we're in trusted, growing relationships with each other and with himself. I think that, going back to Brené Brown's research, true worthiness and truly moving beyond shame and true love and connection and belonging will only happen for us in a relationship with God. I think that it's only God that can take our pain and our brokenness and turn it into something beautiful. Bless you. It doesn't mean that our pain and our hard things aren't hard. It just means that he's with us in the hard places. It means that in his power and creativity, he can redeem that darkness, and he can turn, make us light that shine in the darkness, and he can make beauty from our ashes. Finally, I just want to read a passage from Matthew 5:16 in the Message translation of the Bible that also speaks to lights. Here is another way to put it. You're here to be light, bringing out the God colors in the world. God is not a secret to be kept. We're going public with this, as public as a city on a hill. If I make you light bearers, you don't think I'm going to hide you under a bucket, do you? I'm putting you on a light stand. Now that I've put you there on a hilltop, on a light stand, shine. Keep open house. Be generous with your lives. By opening up to others, you'll prompt people to open up with God, this generous Father in heaven. So let this twinkle lights, and when you see them out in the world, be a reminder of our time together and a reminder about vulnerability and the beauty of vulnerability. There is so much power in just being you fiercely, being you bravely, and offering your beautiful mess, your story, to each other and to the world and to God. And I just want to encourage you and tell you from experience that MOPS is such an amazing and safe place to just start practicing that. And I'm excited for you, especially those of you who are new, to be part of this group. There are discussion questions on your table, and at the bottom of those, there are 5 book titles that I included for you. Those are books that have changed me in some way, shape, or form, and they're all books that speak about vulnerability, and they're all at the library table if you ever want to check them out. Thank you. I went really long. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, honey.
Thank you. I want to say about those books, I'm going to steal your little lapel. About those books that are on there, Emily has graciously donated all of those books to our library, so that is why they are there. So one more big round of applause for Emily for sharing her story, donating, and being such a huge part to what this group is today. Thank you.